From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Montgomery, in for Michael Krasny. In recent years, with the state under a court order to cut prison overcrowding, voters and lawmakers approved measures to reduce penalties for some crimes and allow early release for low-level offenders. Proposition 57, backed by Governor Jerry Brown, continues that trend. It gives more parole opportunities for inmates convicted of nonviolent crimes and allows judges, not prosecutors, to decide whether juveniles should be tried as adults. But opponents say Proposition 57 is vague and puts the public at risk. Forum debates the measure after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Montgomery, in for Michael Krasny. At one time, California had more than 160,000 inmates in state prisons, and it wasn't a pretty picture, with one prisoner dying each week due to poor medical care. Today, that number is around 113,000, just under a cap set by a federal judge. Backers of Proposition 57, including Governor Jerry Brown, say the measure is necessary to end the court's oversight of state prisons. It offers more inmates shorter prison terms through good behavior and enrollment in rehabilitation programs. The measure could also reduce the number of juveniles prosecuted as adults. But opponents say it poses a danger to the public and will drive up crime. First, joining us to talk about all this is Marisa Lagos. She is a reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government desk and has been following this measure very closely. Good morning, Marisa.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with kind of laying out the basics here of this proposition. It sort of has two prongs that were put together. Kind of lay that out for us.
Yeah, well, three really. I'd say one prong dealing with juveniles, and that's the least controversial. So maybe I'll just start with that. This would essentially reverse a policy that was put into place about 16 years ago through a voter initiative also that allowed prosecutors instead of judges to be the ones to decide when somebody was charged as an adult.
So, and that's known as direct file, right?
That's known as direct file. You know, it really varies around the state how much counties use that or if they, you know, charge juveniles at all as adults, depending on what's happening and the sort of the politics of that county. But the idea behind this, and a lot of prosecutors who really oppose this measure don't seem to have as big of a problem with this provision, is that it shouldn't just be up to a prosecutor, that a judge should be able to hear from both sides and make that decision. So I'm sure we can talk about that a little more.
But there's not a lot of controversy on that part of it.
There is not. And that's how this measure started out. It was just that provision. Then the governor got involved and added two adult provisions that it's funny. It is a complicated issue. But if you look at the ballot measure, it's, I think, probably the shortest on the ballot.
Deceptively simple. Right?
Deceptively simple. These two provisions only take up, a quarter of a page of paper. One of them essentially says if you are in prison for a nonviolent felony, and that is defined by the same proposition that created that direct file thing. So Prop 21. It's a short list of the big ones: rape, murder, robbery. If you're not on that list and you're in prison, you could potentially come up for parole earlier than you would have after serving what's known as your base sentence. So essentially, just going back in time, Governor Jerry Brown, the first time he was in Sacramento, signed the law that changed the state from a indeterminate sentencing structure, so really broad ranging sentences, 5 to life. And at that point, a parole board had a lot of discretion over when to let somebody out. In 1976, when the governor signed it, moved us to a determinate sentencing structure. So to say that, you have a 25-year sentence, you have a 50-year sentence. In the years that followed, lawmakers and voters really added on a bunch of what are known as enhancements.
So, and that was during the period people call kind of the get tough period, get tough on crime period.
Absolutely. It kind of started in the 80s and picked up speed in the 90s. We had, three strikes, I think, is one of the more well-known tough on crime laws. And, basically these allowed prosecutors to add on extra time to base sentences. So maybe you had a 10-year sentence for robbery that you were facing, but you had an extra 5 years because you had a previous felony charge, or you were using a gun, or there was a gang enhancement added.
So the ballot measure would allow an inmate to essentially get out prior to that enhancement, or would do away with the enhancement in some cases.
Yeah. So basically, say my example, and I know we have a DA in the line and a very experienced lawyers that are going to correct me on some of this. But pretend you had a charge where you had a 5-year base sentence and 5 years added on for enhancements. What this would say is that after that first 5 years, you could come before the parole board. And if they felt like you were, you know, rehabilitated and really worked to better yourself, they could potentially let you out. So that's pretty well defined, and that's something that the prosecutors are having a lot of challenges with. The second provision is a little more vague, and this would essentially allow the prisons department to kind of start from scratch on the credits, good time credits portion of what essentially allows the state to give not let inmates knock time off their sentences for participating in education programs and drug rehab and other
for behaving, not getting write-ups and that kind of thing.
Exactly. The challenge right now is that it's sort of a patchwork of laws surrounding that. There's, you know, again, various ballot measures, legislation, and there's a lot of people in prison that just don't qualify for these good time credits. So this is really the portion that I think is talked about the least, but stands to be the most impactful, potentially, depending on how those regulations are written, because this could impact all inmates, not just nonviolent offenders. This could impact third right. strikers who were there for 50 to life, right. A lot of people who haven't benefited from previous reform measures.
And so the basic idea here is if you're an inmate in California prison and you're doing well, you're not getting into trouble, you're participating in rehabilitation programs, you might get extra credits for that that will eventually knock a little bit of time off your sentence. And that could apply to virtually all inmates.
It could. I mean, this will go through a regulatory process. All sides will have an opportunity to weigh in and tell CDCR, the corrections department, who they think should apply and who shouldn't. But this, I think, is, you know, stands to be one of the bigger changes we've seen to our prison system.
Okay. And then just one last question for you, let you get back to the newsroom. How is Proposition 57 polling right now?
It's polling really well. We've seen around 60% support in some polls. I think that, you know, it's a crowded ballot. There is a lot of opposition.
It's a very crowded yeah. ballot. It's, I mean, how thick is it?
17 ballot measures. Right. In San Francisco, we have another 24 local ones. Of course, a huge presidential race. But it is polling strongly. Jerry Brown has a pretty big war chest, has put some good money behind it. There hasn't been a ton of money on the opposite side, as we'll hear in this hour. There is a lot of opposition from prosecutors and some law enforcement, although other law enforcement are on board. I just want to mention one thing that I think is interesting, and your guests can kind of debate maybe a little bit. But, you know, one thing that when I talk to people who have looked at criminal justice for years, as you have, Mike, so you might have an opinion on this, that they say is that, you know, in addition to just the sheer number of potential inmates that could benefit from this, one thing that this could do is kind of change some of the dynamics within our judicial system, because there's a lot of cases now, the majority, I believe, that are adjudicated through plea deals. And I think that there is a concern that some of what is happening through 57 and Prop 47 and some of the other previous reforms, you know, has taken away some of the leverage that district attorneys have to push those plea deals. And so I think that there's a bigger shift happening here that's not just about, you know, the number of prisoners, but about sort of how we approach criminal justice. And, you know, is it about rehabilitation and redemption? And is it about who should hold the power, sort of? You're seeing this again, even with the juvenile part. And so I think that that's another interesting thing that maybe isn't what voters are going to go in the ballot box and think about. But I think people who study these issues are looking at it more broadly.
All right, Marisa Lagos, thank you so much.
My
and
pleasure.
We're going to get to our other guest. Marisa Lagos is a reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Now, we are joined by two others. First, we have Anne Marie Schubert. She is the District Attorney of Sacramento County, joining us from Sacramento. Hello, Anne Marie Schubert.
Good morning.
And joining me in the studio is Gabriel Sanchez, Deputy Legal Affairs Secretary in the Governor's Office. Hello, Gabriel.
Good to be with you.
Lots of stuff to talk about, and I want to follow up on Marisa's last point with you, Anne Marie. I'm sure you have some thoughts on that. But first, let me start with you, Gabriel. As it's clear, it's a pretty complicated measure. But I want to ask you what the governor hopes this measure will accomplish.
So the governor has spoken a lot about this in terms of having been the governor when the determinate sentencing law was initially passed.
That's back in 1977.
Correct. And one of the things he had not anticipated, I don't think anyone had anticipated, was the effect in which creating a determinate sentencing process when you have a fixed sentence and no room for change, how that would affect people's behavior in prison and take away any incentive to rehabilitate. And so when you shifted everything over to just serving time in a prison cell, many people, I think, underestimated the effect that that would have on people's efforts to then try and rehabilitate when they got out.
So just to be clear, so what we're talking about is someone who gets, say, a 10-year sentence fixed and they have a release date versus someone who might get a 5 to 15-year sentence where their release date could be dependent on how they do behind bars, whether they take part in rehabilitation programs. That's sort of the idea here.
Right. And for that, under the previous system that had been around for 60-some years, that 5 to 15-year date or 5 to life, a person would go in front of a parole board. Every inmate would go in front of a parole board and demonstrate that they had changed, that they had taken responsibility, rehabilitated themselves. With the change in the law where most inmates now in prison are determinately sentenced, they have a fixed sentence, you've taken away that incentive to rehabilitate. And that has public safety consequences in my view and the governor's view because everyone is eventually going to get out of prison. It's just a matter of how, and if that incentive is not there for them to improve their lives, to take drug treatment or college courses or something else, then we're not in a better place when they do get out.
And the federal judges have made it really clear that California has to have a long-term plan here, where California is now under the cap, the population cap set by federal court. But California has to show that there's a long-term plan in order for essentially this case to go away and assume that's one of the goal, a big goal here.
That's correct. So a few years back, when the prison population, you alluded to this, had reached almost double capacity, it was considered dangerous and overcrowded. And a prison order, a federal court order said the state had to be below a population cap, and that was affirmed by the United States Supreme Court. And so part of this process is there have been several measures, including a nonviolent parole measure that has already been in place for the last 18 months and certain credit changes. And Prop 57 would codify, put those things into law to create that long-term solution. There are estimates that the prison population is starting to grow again. So in the absence of doing something else, we do face a real risk that one day if the population gets above the population cap, there will be automatic federal court-ordered releases. And no one wants to be in that situation where people are released for no reason other than just an arbitrary order as opposed to a system that provides incentives for people to get in front of a parole board and demonstrate that they have rehabilitated themselves and are safe to be released.
Well, one reason the prison population may be going up a little bit is crime is going up a little bit. But I want to go to you. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. I want to go to you, Anne-Marie Schubert. You've been waiting very patiently. You and most other district attorneys, in fact, almost all other district attorneys in California, you oppose Proposition 57. Give me a sense of why you oppose it.
Well, I think you have to look at the history of the last 5 years in this state, starting with realignment, then Prop 47, and now we have Prop 57, which is some people have said is Prop 47 on steroids. And, you know, I understand that the governor has a problem, and I understand that. But the reality is that this initiative is so far-reaching, so, as you say, deceptively vague, that not only are we going to be releasing very dangerous people, which we already are doing under the already early release programs the governor has set into place, but we're going to end up with years of litigation over what is the definition of some of these things. And I think the biggest concern that prosecutors have and law enforcement, we shouldn't leave out law enforcement, crime victims, many, many city councils, many governments that see that this problem is just simply going to be dumped on their neighborhoods, but is what is the definition of nonviolent? Because what's being touted out there by the Yes on 57 campaign is, oh, it's only nonviolent. So you ask yourself, and when I go speak to the members of my community is, do you think domestic violence is a nonviolent crime? They all say, no, it's violent. How about hate crimes? How about assault with a deadly weapon? How about human trafficking of minors? How about child molest of certain children? Gang crimes. Those are all, quote unquote, nonviolent. So we're talking about crimes that are, in fact, very violent. And we know from history, I mean, we all want to project and, oh, it's only going to be safe. They're going to earn their way out of prison. But what we're seeing already in our communities is the governor's early release programs already set by the three-judge panel involve individuals that are extremely dangerous, that the the administrative reviews. Remember, these are not parole hearings. They're not parole boards. They are paper reviews where we have no right to be present. A judge doesn't decide if they're safe to release. It's an administrative person in the Department of Corrections that's saying that this person is, you know, not an unreasonable risk to the community. And so I give many, many examples. I'm all for rehab. I absolutely believe that individuals need to have those skill sets to get out. I don't believe all people are getting out of prison, probably somewhere around 90 to 95%. But to give you one example of somebody that is already a letter has been sent on, but Philip Garrido, everybody knows who that guy is. He's a despicable human being who kidnapped J.C. DeGarde, held her for 18 years, impregnated her, and ultimately she was rescued. But they've already sent a letter saying he's eligible for early release. Now, he got 431 years to life. Okay, everybody's going to say, well, he's never going to get out. He's never going to get out. Okay, that may be true, but why in the world would you ever send a letter on that person? Why would you ever make him eligible? So, and quite frankly, in my opinion, when we get to the root of all these things, it is disgraceful to crime victims who've had the guts and the fortitude to come forward, report their crimes, whether it's domestic violence, assault with a deadly weapon, hate crimes, those types of things, that they should ever, ever have to go back and try to argue against the early release. You know, the first provision of the initiative, which is taking away prosecutors' discretion, giving it back to judges, I agree with many people that it's not something that we all have heartache about. But I think it's ironic that you transfer that power to judges, but now under the other two provisions, you're taking away the power from the judges, who are the ones that are best suited to make decisions on what is this person's background, what are the facts of the crime. You know, I live in the trenches every day. Judges live in the trenches. Defense attorneys live in the trenches. But we're transferring this wholesale decision to individuals that are essentially making paper reviews.
And we're talking about Proposition 57. That's the criminal justice reform measure backed by Governor Brown. And with us, you've just been hearing Anne Marie Schubert. Anne Marie Schubert is district attorney for Sacramento County. And in the studio with me is Gabriel Sanchez, deputy legal affairs secretary in the governor's office. I want to go to you, Gabriel. There's a lot that Anne Marie Schubert has been saying about the dangers that this measure poses. I want to start first, and this has been out there a lot, that some of the people who could benefit from this measure in terms of getting out earlier than their original sentence and enhancements. We say that they were prosecuted for nonviolent offenses, but in fact, there's a feeling among certainly prosecutors and law enforcement that these are dangerous people or potentially dangerous people, and that the crimes they committed, perhaps nonviolent according to the legal code, but really serious, in some ways violent offenses. What's your response to that?
Well, I guess I'd start by saying that what's disappointing is that these are what appear to me to be scare tactics designed to scare people from opposing common sense reforms. It's the same argument that has been raised in opposition to every effort to reform the system. It's not a new story. It's been used many times. But point one, the assumption behind all that is that people will be automatically released, and that just will not happen. This is parole eligibility. And so certain people will potentially be eligible for parole, but they have to go through very rigorous public safety screens and get in front of a parole board, which will look at the entirety of their case, their criminal history, their criminal record, what they've done both positively and negative in prison. They will read submissions from victims, from district attorneys. It's not true that that groups are excluded from the process. They are included. And when they look at the totality of those circumstances, they make a decision as to whether someone is safe for release or not. And it's been happening for the last 18 months. And what I would disagree with Ms. Schubert is whether it's been happening safely or otherwise. Thus far, what we have seen is that people who have been released under the nonviolent court-ordered parole process, about 1% or less than 1% have returned to prison on a new felony conviction.
Now, these were ordered by the panel of federal judges, and this kind of set in motion, or the governor says that what's in the measure is an extension of what the court has already ordered. That's what we're talking about.
That's correct. So the court-ordered process, this is not a blank – Prop 57 would not be working from a blank slate. It would be working from a process that's been underway for the last 18 months, and it has rigorous public safety protections. So if someone is a registered sex offender, for example, they are automatically excluded from parole consideration.
Go ahead. Sorry.
So that includes people with rape convictions, with human trafficking convictions, with molestation convictions. And the Department of Corrections determined that those sorts of crimes were ones that posed more of a risk that shouldn't allow them to be in front of the parole board. So in addition, you know, getting beyond the violent, nonviolent debate, Prop 57 takes the violent list in the penal code as it is, but then adds additional restrictions on top of that.
But now, what about the second point, though, that these actually won't all be parole hearings? And I've sat in many parole hearings and have found them very rigorous. And, you know, lots of people who come up for parole are denied. And I think more the majority, actually. But some of these cases would not be formal hearings. They would essentially be on paper only. And that's clearly a concern on the side of district attorneys, law enforcement, and others. What's your response to that?
Well, so as was alluded to earlier, the regulations will spell out how this is going to work in practice. Currently, the court order provides for a parole for a paper review process. Where I disagree is that it's not a rigorous process. The parole board members, who are experienced law enforcement and corrections officials, they all come from the sort of a very conservative bend. They look at all these cases and look at the totality of the circumstances. And as I said earlier, everyone's voice and input is heard. What is not there is a live hearing process, which is reserved right now for life-term inmates, for people that have been convicted of murder and life offenses.
Those are people who have indeterminate sentences, 25 to life, thus the need for a parole hearing.
That's correct. And so this process, this nonviolent process currently is for the most part getting at what a person needs to have without providing that hearing itself.
Anne Marie Schubert, we just have a couple minutes or 1 minute before the break. Quickly, what are your thoughts on what Gabriel Sanchez has said?
Well, I don't think he realizes who's being released. I'll give you one example of somebody that's, quote, nonviolent, a guy named Gregory Williams who walked into a Bank of America here in Sacramento, used very graphic terms, threatened to shoot everybody, simulated a gun. He was unsuccessful because they had bulletproof glass. He was convicted of attempted bank robbery. That's a nonviolent crime under the penal code. He had 7 prior robberies with the use of a gun. The parole board or the parole review committee decided he was safe because he was nonviolent. And that is, you know, when you talk about scare tactics, it's scary that Gregory Williams got out. So when we talk about these things, you need to understand what's already happening. And many of these folks have little to no rehab. They're taking a computer class, and that's qualifying for rehab. That's not meaningful rehab.
Okay. Well, we'll continue our conversation about Proposition 57 after a short break. What questions do you have for our guests? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, in for Michael Krasny, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Montgomery, in today for Michael Krasny. One of the many initiatives on the fall ballot is Proposition 57. It gives some state inmates the opportunity of early parole, earlier than their full sentence and enhancements would have had, and could reduce the number of juveniles being prosecuted as adults. We're talking with Anne Marie Schubert, District Attorney for Sacramento County, and Gabriel Sanchez. He is the Deputy Legal Affairs Secretary in the Governor's Office. Please give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I have a couple of comments here. Tom says, I haven't heard one word about the victims of crimes. And Bill writes, it looks to me like the people engaged in the business of arresting, prosecuting, and incarcerating people resist all reforms. Anne Marie Schubert, I want to go back to you and ask you this question. I covered Proposition 36. That was the changes to the three strikes law. And I remember folks in district attorneys, law enforcement, the Sheriff's Association, you know, painting a very bleak picture of what would happen after Prop 47, making the same assertions that some of these inmates were, may have been convicted of, quote, nonviolent offenses, but they were, in fact, dangerous inmates. I don't think we've really seen a lot of problems with many of these inmates. The recidivism rate has been very low. So I wanted to ask you, why will this be different? Why are you, given the history of, or the experience of Prop 36, how will this time be different?
Well, I think the thing, I wasn't involved when I wasn't the DA when Prop 36 came around, and I don't have tremendous heartache about it. But what we know now is that really the prison population is really only now comprised of the most dangerous people that we can imagine. And so this particular initiative is so far-reaching, and, you know, because it repeals so many initiatives, Marcy's Law obviously is going to potentially repeal three strikes. It repeals the human trafficking Prop 35 that was passed. And I think the biggest danger that we face is that it completely transfers, you know, all this power from a judicial officer, from a judge, to bureaucrats within the Department of Corrections. The credits provision is extremely it's probably the least talked about, but probably the most dangerous, because it you know, let's remember that, you know, with all due respect to the corrections, because I have great respect for them, but, you know, the ultimate regulations, which are not written, let's all be clear, they're not written. When Mr. Sanchez promises these things, they're not written. So when he says 290 sex offenders are going to be excluded, that's not, we don't know that. We know that there are already, you know, people like Philip Garrido, who is a sex offender, has already had a letter sent for him. So there's some things that are very damning about this, which is, you know, we don't know. They make a lot of promises, but why aren't we vetting these before we impose them upon Californians? And so it's that part of it, but you also have to look at, over the last 5 years, you know, crime rate is going up. Murder's up 9.7. Rapes are up 36%. Hate crimes are up, all these other types of crimes. And so when you're starting to look at us as a state, and I am very much for meaningful rehabilitation. I'd like to be part of that conversation. I think I have some insight into those types of discussions. But this wholesale delivery of criminal justice reform to a non-judicial officer and somebody that is, you know, part of the administrative review process, I think is a very dangerous proposition.
Well, I want to give Gabriel Sanchez a chance to respond. But Anne-Marie Schuler, I do want to ask you about the crime rate. There have been, you know, it's a tricky thing to show cause and effect in terms of the crime rates. Do you have, would you say you can prove that the crime is the result of these, you know, ballot initiatives, Prop 36?
I want to say, you know, this caused that. But what we know is we've had all these things. I think Prop 47 was the biggest con job in California history because it was touted as a Safe Schools and Neighborhood Act when it's the most farthest thing from the truth. And again, I think people are realizing I'm absolutely support people that steal. Typically, a lot of them have drug problems, but we're no longer having consequences for behavior. I believe in hope for people in prison. Absolutely. I understand the governor's point. I understand Scott Budnick's point on the juvenile component, and I support that. But there also has to be accountability, and rehabilitation has to be meaningful. And what we're seeing now with the early releases is that, you know, to me, I'm sorry, a computer class doesn't cut it when somebody's got a long-term history of anger management or long-term history of drug problems. And anybody that's worth their weight in rehabilitation is going to tell you that it typically takes 12 to 18 months to get to the root of their issues. And right now, it just seems to me that they're just letting them out because that's what they need to do is empty some of the bed space.
And we're talking about Proposition 57. That's the criminal justice reform ballot initiative that's supported by Governor Jerry Brown. With us is Anne-Marie Schubert, District Attorney of Sacramento County, and Gabriel Sanchez, Deputy Legal Affairs Secretary in the Governor's Office. I want to take a call. We're going to go to David in Kentfield, who has some thoughts on the recent shooting in Palm Springs. Hi, David. You're on for him.
Very much for taking my call. You know, I have to agree with Ms. Schubert. You know, there is increasing crime in the state, and there are a number of examples in which criminals who have been sent to jail have been otherwise released so long as they go to rehabilitation programs and whatnot, and then they don't show up and there's never a penalty. But specifically, I'd like Mr. Sanchez to address his comment that there's a bunch of scare tactics around opposition to 57 when, you know, the shooter in Palm Springs had a criminal record and had been cited and arrested for, violations of his parole that had originally sent him to prison, which were gang-related activities with guns, and then was able to, shoot and kill two police officers. There's another case down in Southern California in which someone shot and killed an off-duty USC security guard. That person was released, got in trouble, was never sent back, and has also shot two police officers. So I don't believe that it's scare tactics, and I would really appreciate Mr. Sanchez addressing that, and perhaps he could say what the ordinary citizen is supposed to do to protect themselves with Prop 63 coming on the ballot as well.
Okay, David, thanks for your comment. Gabriel Sanchez, to you.
First of all, I agree with the caller that those were incredibly tragic events, the shooting of the police officer in Palm Springs and the other in Lancaster. What I would say is I think those incidents really call for the reform that's needed. If people are going to be released in any event at the end of their sentence, no matter what, whether they are doing well in prison or not doing well, it behooves the state and all of us to do a better job than we're doing of making sure that that they have the opportunity and the incentive to be rehabilitated so that when they are released, we don't have those tragic incidents happening again. For context, there are 40,000 people released from prison every single year, far larger than what parole provides or other things. So we have a much larger system than what this even parole process even contemplates. And if 57 passes and it can achieve some measure of incentivizing people to become rehabilitated and to have to go through the really hard steps of proving to a parole board that they are worthy of release because they've taken drug treatment and other things, I think we hopefully will have fewer of those terrible, tragic instances than otherwise. The other thing I wanted to mention just in response to a comment Ms. Schubert made about repealing prior laws, 57 does nothing of the kind. It doesn't change sentencing laws at all. It doesn't change the DA's discretion to charge on crimes. It doesn't change the judge's discretion to sentence. What it does is it gives discretion to prison officials years later to look at a prison – not a prison – to look at an inmate 2, 5, 10 years down the road and see, have they changed since they were sentenced? Have they improved themselves? And if not, then nothing happens. Nothing changes. Their sentence remains the same. But if they have taken steps to better their lives, to take responsibility and do better things, then they might be released a little bit sooner.
Anne-Marie Schubert, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's – first of all, I think he's wrong. It clearly reverses Marcy Law, which was one of the greatest crime victims' rights initiatives passed in California, which specifically said that prison sentences shall not be reduced simply because you have overcrowding. But I think for more of a in the real world of what happens in our courtrooms is you have, for instance, a domestic violence victim who was beaten terribly by her abuser, and that person is sentenced to 25 years because of his record and because of various things in his background. You gave a promise. That judge gave a promise to that victim in court who had the guts to come forward that, you don't have to worry about Mr. Jones because he's going to be in prison. This is how many percentage of credits he can earn. And they have a surety. And now that's gone. And Mr. Sanchez keeps saying parole board hearing. There's absolutely nothing in the initiative that says that we are guaranteed of a parole board hearing. What it says is parole consideration, which could, again, go back to this paper review where victims don't have a right to be present. Prosecutors, defense attorneys don't have a right to be present. We get to do a letter writing campaign. And it's very frustrating when we've spent years and years advocating on behalf of victims' rights so that they can have a surety of what's going to happen in the system. And that's completely neglected.
And we are talking about Proposition 57. That's the ballot measure supported by the governor that would give inmates more opportunities for possible parole. There are concerns, though, among prosecutors, law enforcement, and others, including victims' crimes groups, that this could lead to the release of dangerous inmates. I want to take another call here. I want to go to Chris in Oakland, who has thoughts on the parole process. Oh, sorry. We're going to go to Sutter in Los Angeles. It was a question about what might happen if the measure doesn't pass. Sutter, you're on forum. Go ahead.
No, you got Chris.
I got Chris. Well, Chris, you go ahead then. Chris in Oakland.
All right. As part of the original struggle over the determinate and indeterminate sentences in the 70s, there was a lawsuit by public advocates trying to figure out how the parole process worked. And they pretty much showed it was a racist scam. They deposed parole board members and asked them to define terms that they had used in deciding whether somebody should be let out or not. They couldn't. Asked them to define how the psychological terms they had used were related to the possibility of further dangerousness. They couldn't. These were a bunch of cops and prison guards who basically decided on the basis of somebody's color whether they were dangerous or not. So just as there needs to be a whole lot of regulations that talk about how this is going to work, I think a whole lot of improvement needs to be made to the parole system before anything like this can work.
All right, Chris, thanks for your comment. I think we're going to go to Sutter who in Los Angeles who has a comment. Sutter, you're on forum.
Hello, this is Isaac.
My mistake again. I'm not working the board very well. Isaac in Berkeley, go ahead. You have a question.
Thank you, and thank you, guests, for talking about this very important topic. I'm going to try to stay calm and ask Ms. Schubert, how can you be against Prop 57 when you know that your office overcharges every person who's arrested every time they get arrested? Not sometimes. Every time they get arrested, you layer charge after charge after charge, knowing that in the plea process, you're going to knock them down. And knowing, too, that if the arrestee has money, they can get the case dismissed or turned to a misdemeanor. And if they don't, and they're usually the poor and the brown and the black, if they don't, they'll probably get charged, stuck with those felonies and those overchargings that you've done, and then wind up in prison. Prop 57 gives them at least a chance to mitigate the cruel duplicity that your office represents. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks to Isaac in Berkeley. Emery Schubert, this does raise questions about the ability to do plea bargains, and as we know, most cases end in plea bargains, don't go to trial. What are your thoughts on that, Anne-Marie Schubert?
Well, I think that the plea bargaining system is you know, been part of the process across California, across this country. You know, we try to take in when we're looking at facts and circumstances of cases, we are always trying to look at, you know, what are the facts of the crime, what is the background of the individual, and then make a decision from there. I mean, honestly, in most cases, for somebody to even really earn a trip to state prison, most often they've already been put on multiple grants of felony probation, misdemeanor probation. And so we try the best we can to make sure that that person, you know, avails himself of rehab long before they ever go to the potential of going to state prison. So we have tremendous courts in our county and many across the state where we're trying to do everything we can to keep them out of jail. So we have a lot of like veterans court, drug court, mental health court, many different things that are designed, you know, Prop 36 court to get them back on track, because the last thing we want for somebody is to end up in that state prison route. But the reality is that, you know, ultimately people have to make choices for themselves. And again, similar to Mr. Sanchez, is that, you know, most people are going to come out of prison and we want them to have the best skill set that we can.
Gabriel Sanchez, I want to get to you, but I do want to take this call from Sutter in Los Angeles. Sutter, thanks for being so patient. You're on forum.
Both advocates and are articulate spokespeople for their particular viewpoint, but we're missing the 800-pound gorilla in the room. What happens if this doesn't pass? What happens to the prison population and the flood of inmates back onto the streets if the federal courts take over if it doesn't pass and basically makes their own determination about who should be out and who should not be out?
Okay, Sutter, thanks for your call. So the question is, we still have the federal court order that the prison population has to stay down. It's below the cap. But, it, you know, if it goes up again, then, you know, the courts could push a much more, you know, draconian measure. Is that a serious possibility, Gabriel Sanchez?
It is. So the order that requires the state to stay below the population level also has a provision that has the court has appointed an official who already has the authority to exercise to order the release of inmates if the state goes above the prison cap. So it's a very real risk that if we don't do anything and allow the prison population to grow again, that you face the indiscriminate release of prisoners by this court official, as opposed to a sensible common sense process that we're trying to implement here through Prop 57.
Anne-Marie Schubert, I want to ask you about that. So the idea here is that if you may not like this ballot initiative, but you probably wouldn't like at all the idea of inmates, kind of a mass release of inmates. What's your take on that?
Well, my take is I'm all for having a meaningful, healthy discussion about sentencing reform. I think it's time for us to have that conversation. But this initiative is not that. It's a wholesale transfer of authority, essentially from the judicial branch back to the Department of Corrections. And what we're seeing already is the release of individuals that are very dangerous. So, you know, I think, you know, the fact that these regulations are not written is very, very, very concerning. And I think the comment by the caller previously that, you know, the parole system needs to be seriously looked at. Let's have the conversation before you impose this on California voters and call it some release of nonviolent people, because that's not only deceptive, but it's misleading to the public.
I want to go to a comment from Andrew. Very good question here. It seems like Proposition 57, he writes, would go hand in hand with improving rehabilitation services. What efforts would be made to expand rehabilitation, education, or restorative justice in California prisons? And you know, that's a biggie. We've seen over the years, I've been to many prisons where there really wasn't a lot going on. And I know that the department has made efforts. It's enhanced the budget for these things. But it's true that, you know, you're going to have, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Department of Corrections to deliver on rehabilitation programs, because that's kind of essential to the logic of this measure. If inmates are not getting access to the programs, either they're not going to be released, or when they are released, the chances of them returning to prison are going to be much higher. Gabriel Sanchez.
That's absolutely right. There is more rehabilitation under recent budgets. Several hundred millions more have been added in each budget cycle. But more needs to be done. There are now core rehabilitative programs at every prison and reentry services. People are taught about job vocational work, drug treatment, cognitive behavior therapy and anger management, a variety of things. But I think it's true that the department could do more of that job. And this lays the framework for doing that and making sure that as rehabilitation gets enhanced, that the parole process and credit process is in place to take advantage of that, so that people are better prepared when they do get released.
Okay, I want to go to another caller. Mike in Sacramento has some thoughts about district attorneys and the idea of overcharging. Mike, go ahead.
Good morning. This is Mike. Hello to you and your guests. I've been doing this over 30 years. I'm a defense attorney. My office is in Sacramento, and I'm practicing a lot of the different counties in Northern California. And the young man that called in from Berkeley, he is just so off the mark. The DA's office, when I go out of county to other counties, Placer, Yolo, Yuba County, then I come back to Sacramento, I'm happy to be back in Sacramento. The DA's office has a lot of wonderful, hardworking people. There may be a case every now and then I think they overcharge, but it certainly is not uniform.
So, Mike, you're a defense attorney.
I am.
I see.
I am. And I know of DA Schubert, don't know her personally. But I do know from the other attorneys I know in Sacramento and Bonson that I know, she's a very fact-based person. She does not use scare tactics. We're very fortunate to have someone like her as the new DA. And I just, like I said, it's awesome. And for Mr. Sanchez, I've done Morrissey hearings. The idea that a prospective parolee would have a paper exercise rather than having an opportunity for some input, I'm just wondering, did the DAs of the state and the different law enforcement organizations, do they have input in the drafting of this Prop 57? Because from what the crimes that Ms. Schubert outlined, I've defended those cases, and they almost all involve some type of violence. And to classify them as nonviolent is just that's just ignoring the facts of, you know, the reality of what goes on. So that's my comment.
Okay, Mike, thanks for your call. Gabriel Sanchez, again, the question about how this would play out, we have parole hearings where an inmate is taken to a hearing room and you have commissioners largely from law enforcement. But in this case, this ballot initiative, many of these cases wouldn't be handled in face-to-face hearings. It would be done through sort of paperwork, and there are concerns about that. Again, what are your thoughts?
Well, let me reference back to the caller's first question about the input. There was extensive input from the governor's office, from myself, from the governor himself. We reached out to a wide variety of stakeholders, sheriffs, association, to police chiefs, the district attorneys multiple times, probation chiefs, faith leaders, juvenile advocates. We reached far and wide and got their input as we were talking through these issues. And there were changes made as a result of those conversations. So it was extensively thought through, and we got valuable input from different people. Back to the parole process, these commissioners are also the same ones that handle life cases. So they are all experienced. They look at these cases in the exact same way. They look at an earlier caller had mentioned that regulations need to be in place, and they will need to be in place to implement this. But there are already extensive regulations for the parole process that currently exists, and these are factors for suitability and unsuitability. They look at what happened in the crime, a person's criminal history, whether they've been convicted multiple times before. And also what they've done in prison, you know, have they been disciplined many times? Have they done positive programming? I have personal experience seeing how extensive that parole process is, and it goes into minute detail as to what a person is like and how have they changed.
And I want to get to more comments, lots of comments coming in. Eddie writes, the status quo is clearly not working. Ms. Schubert doesn't sound interested in providing a better solution or alternative to this proposition. I believe it is better to move forward with reform and make adjustments as we learn the lessons and unintended consequences of this change. Justin writes, what about the effect plea bargains had on those sentences? A judge who has heard all the details reasons out and comes up with a sentence. Now we are going to change that with a broad brush affecting all sentences. I want to get to another caller here. I want to go to Roger in San Francisco, who I believe has a question for Anne-Marie Schubert. Roger, go ahead.
My question to Ms. Schubert was, why does she believe... and I don't have an opinion either way. I'm really just asking because she's obviously more experienced in this field than I am. You know, why wouldn't a prison official who sees and interacts with inmates on a daily basis in many different contexts, why wouldn't they be almost in a better position than a judicial officer to make these kinds of determinations?
Okay, thanks for your call. Anne-Marie Schubert, go ahead.
Can I answer that?
Yes, please.
Well, there's, you know, the prison official that's doing the paper review is not somebody that's interacting with the inmate. So that's not, it's not the same as, like, say, for a probation officer or somebody like a parole officer who's interacting daily or, you know, monthly or whatever to see what the meaningful rehab is. It's purely a paper review process. So, you know, I think it goes back to the same question of, you know, when Mr. Sanchez talks about it's a parole board, there's nothing in this initiative that says that. And quite frankly, when there's 16,000 people that are immediately eligible for release under this, I don't know how you would ever have the capacity for a parole board hearing as opposed to just a paper review.
Okay, I want to take one more caller here, and I want to go to Timothy in San Jose. I think he has a question for Gabriel Sanchez. Timothy, go ahead. You're on forum.
For Mr. Sanchez and Ms. Schubert, the victims' rights law history has been a struggle, and constitutional victims' rights and the Constitution of California and the statutes that support it are flaunted by judges. Probation officers, when they make the reports, they don't call affected victims witnesses to give their statements. It's just the flaunting of the law is what the experience is. It's been a struggle, and yet they flaunt the law, even with the law on the books.
All right, Timothy, thanks for your comment. Gabriel Sanchez, just quickly, your thoughts.
So the current nonviolent parole process provides that whenever an inmate is referred or sent on to the parole board for parole consideration, every DA that handled that case is sent a notice of that case. And every victim that has registered is also allowed to provide input, and they're given 30 days to write in. And DAs do it on average about 30% of the time, and victims far less so.
Henry Schubert, just a couple seconds for your final words.
Again, I think it's important for us to stand up for victims, and that's what our job is, not just for victims but also public safety. And when you look at the continuing increase in crime in California, ultimately, you know, I'm all about reform, but this is not the manner to do it.
All right. Thank you. We've been talking about Proposition 57. That's the criminal justice reform measure on the ballot. We've been talking to Henry Schubert, District Attorney of Sacramento County, and Gabriel Sanchez, Deputy Legal Affairs in the Governor's Office. Thank you for joining us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Montgomery, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.